two guests from out of town who we're really excited to have. We have Sam Gindin from Toronto, and we have Bob Brenner, who's just leaving from UCLA.
To my immediate left
is Vivek Chimmer, who's on the Left Forum Board of Directors and teaches sociology at NYU, and he's going to moderate this evening.
Thanks very much, Julie. The event, it's been called When Neoliberalism Implodes. And on the left, of course, we're famous for always predicting a crisis right around the corner. I think it was Paul Samuelson who once said, Marxists have predicted 10 out of the last 6 crises. But there is a sense that there are tremors and there are cracks right now. There are fault lines in the edifice, in the ruling order. It starts with the recent the crisis in the financial markets, with the collapse of the housing sector and the subprime crisis, which is part of what our speakers will talk about today. But also the implosion in Iraq of American aggression and the consequences for American power worldwide, where you see diplomatically American influence waning, and across the world, political events careening out of the control of the United States, whose foreign policy has been geared for 50 years towards being a factor in every important political decision that occurs regionally. And you see that power receding month after month after month. And finally, the level of simple disconnect in the population with the incredible inequalities that are growing up, the persistence of low wage growth, the continuing destruction of the cities, and the complete unresponsiveness of the political order. So there's a sense that there are really cracks in the edifice. On the other side, when you look at what's happening in the movements, what's surprising and somewhat disconcerting is that the response to this crisis is still pretty muted. It starts with the Democratic Party, which has not only retreated and kicked on every important issue in the last, every important promise in the last 4 years, but is actually aiding and abetting the ongoing restriction of civil liberties and all the assaults that are being made on people's freedoms, with this last set of laws on surveillance being the best example. The retreat on every promise it's made to end the war.
Japanese crop.
There's the pervasive and strong sentiment against the war in the population. But at the same time, the anti-war movement in the past year, 2 years, has really gotten a lot weaker and is harder and harder to find as a powerful presence in the political scene. And finally, the labor movement, which most recently with the auto agreement has given yet more givebacks to the big three in concession after concession. So while the dominant order seems to be in some kinds of trouble, if not crisis, the response to it is still not where anybody on the left or a progressive would like it to be. To analyze this, to make some sense of the crisis, how deep it is, and to give some analysis of what room there is for movements and what potential there is for left organizing, we have two, I think, absolutely terrific speakers. Sam Gindin, to my left here, has for most of his life been involved with the Canadian auto workers and was special assistant to the president of the Canadian auto workers in the 1980s, now holds a chair at York University in the politics department in Toronto, Canada. He is also author, among other books, most recently of this book called Global Capitalism and American Empire, co-author with Leo Panitch. Mm-hmm. Next to him is Robert Brenner, who is professor of history at UCLA in Los Angeles. Bob has also been in the left and left organizing for all of his adult life, actually. And most recently is author of this book, The Economics of Global Turbulence, brought out by Verso. Both of these books are on sale in the back, so please check them out first chance you get. Each speaker will speak for about 30 to 35 minutes. Afterwards, we'll have about an hour for questions and answers. And there's a mic here that'll be, actually, this one. It'll be passed around when it comes time for questions and answers. So Bob will speak first, and after that will be, I think, Sam, right?
Organizers of the Breck Forum,
for inviting me here. It's really great to be back in New York and to be able to speak to a left audience instead of an academic audience, which all too often I'm stuck with. So it's a real pleasure. It feels a bit like old home week, and I'm very glad to see so many people I know and so many people I don't know, which is even better. So in a certain sense, no offense. Too many of these events, you know, we all come see each other at, and too few new people. But I think a lot of new people are coming around these days, and it's a very exciting, I think it's a very exciting moment. Okay, what I want to do in this talk is offer an account of where the U.S. and world economy is at today and where it's going. I'll begin by providing a sort of big picture of the course of the world economy over the post-war epoch as a whole. Then I'll try to hone in on the present crisis by picking up the story at what seems to me a key break or shift. That's in the early years of the Clinton administration. At this point, the U.S. and the EU finally made a decisive turn away from traditional Keynesianism and, not accidentally, I'll argue, moved almost immediately thereafter to the bubble economics that has driven the world economy ever since. It's in the dual shift in the early middle 90s to the appearance of economic governance by way of the free market and the reality of economic governance by way of state-supported financial bubbles that one can, I think, find the shorter term, I emphasize shorter term origins of the current crisis. Okay, so to begin with, as is well understood, the post-war economy naturally divides itself into two parts, a long boom from the end of the 40s to 1973, and a long downturn from 1973 onwards. Nevertheless, for more than a decade, the financial press and politicians have assured us time and again that we're at the end of stagnation and on the verge of a great new boom, or are actually in such a boom. But the facts of the matter are quite different. Not only has the long downturn persisted right into the present, but for the advanced capitalist economies, there's been a more or less continuous worsening of performance in terms of virtually all the standard economic indicators, business cycle by business cycle. In fact, during the last 6.5 years, for the new cycle that began in February 2001, the performance of the US economy and the advanced capitalist countries more generally has been the worst for any comparable period since 1950. For a quick take on this, and I assume everyone has that handout, just take a look at page 1, declining economic dynamism, especially the last column, the far right column. So you can just, you get a kind of a fairly clear panorama there. What accounts for this pattern of economic performance? In my view, the key is the pattern of profitability. For the period from the end of the 40s to the later 1960s, you have persistently high profitability. That is, profits over capital stock, or the profits that firms made compared to the plant equipment they put into operation. From the mid-60s, you have a major fall in the rate of profit, and no doubt most important, there is no recovery of the rate of profit right through the end of the century, and indeed to today. So it would be my most general proposition that persistently high profit rates accounted for the long post-war boom, that the shift from high to reduced rates of profit from the 60s to the mid-60s to the mid-70s accounted for the transition from boom to stagnation, and the persistently low profit rates accounted for the long downturn, I emphasize, extending right into the present. And you can see this by consulting the line graphs on pages 2 and 3, and also table on page 4, where you get the average rate of profit for post-war business cycles. And for data right up to the present, that is to the middle of 2007, look at the last two graphs on pages 10 and 11. The last two graphs may be the ones you're most interested in because they're the ones that bring the story right up to through the second quarter of 2007. Now, the underlying theory behind this proposition about the profit rates and the path, trajectory of the economy is pretty straightforward. First, the rate of profit is a rough and ready determinant of the surpluses firms have at their disposal. In addition, the realized rate of profit, the profit that firms got in the past, is the best predictor they have of prospective profits, that is, of the future profits they can expect. So when the profit rate is high, you get high investment, that is, rapid growth of plant and equipment, and high growth of employment. When profitability is low, you get the reverse, slow increase of investment and employment. And if we apply these generalizations about profitability and capital accumulation to the post-war period as a whole, we can get an initial understanding of the pattern of economic evolution. Between 48 and the late 60s, profitability remained high and made for the long boom. But between 65 and 73, the profit rate fell, and it fell further between 73 and 79. And it never did recover during the following couple decades. The result was that the growth of plant and equipment or capital stock and of employment fell. Because the growth of capital stock fell, the growth of plant and equipment per worker fell, and productivity declined. Productivity growth declined. The decline of productivity growth made it more difficult for the economy to accommodate wage increase. So it put further downward pressure on profitability in the economy. Because not only the growth of productivity, but also the increase of employment, that is the demand for labor, declined, so did real wage growth. The upshot has been declining economic dynamism for the advanced capitalist countries since 1973. And again, take a look at that first set of data on page one. Now, you can look at this same progression from the standpoint of demand, the direct driver of the economy, if you will. Because the profit rate fell, firms had smaller surpluses, so they cut back on capital accumulation, and the result was the declining growth of investment demand, meaning the demand for new plant and equipment. Because the profit rate fell, firms reduced the growth of employment and the growth of wages, with the result that consumer demand fell. Because governments saw it to help capital to improve the conditions for profitability, they reduced the growth of government spending, especially on social services, so the growth of government demand fell. Because the growth of investment demand plus consumer demand plus government demand fell and continued to do so, we got economic stagnation and indeed worsening economic stagnation. We can therefore conclude that the fall in the rate of profit and the failure of the rate of profit to recover has made for the long decline and stagnation of aggregate demand growth and stagnation that has made for the stagnation of the economy. And I can portray this progression from decline in profit rate to ever worsening stagnation of demand on pages 4 and 5, which as you can see, proceeds from profit rates to investment, to labor productivity, then to employment and compensation person, then to aggregate compensation and the growth of government spending. So and those two pages kind of encapsulated at least my view of what's happened over the post-war period. Well, if the decline and especially the failure of the recovery of profitability is behind the long period of slow growth, the fundamental question is obviously what was responsible for the trajectory of the profit rate itself. Why did the rate of profit fall, and why did it stay down and fail to recover? Well, this is, of course, a huge theoretical and historical question, and too big, really, to discuss, for me to discuss here. It just would take up the whole talk. For our purposes, I'm just going to state flat out and without further explanation that, in my view, the basic cause of the fall in the rate of profit is basically the onset and persistence of a chronic tendency to overcapacity in world manufacturing production. Of course, if people want to discuss this, we can do so in the question period. I'm very happy. I'm not trying to pass over this question. Obviously spent a lot of time on it. I don't know to what effect, but it's certainly something to be very happy to discuss and argue about. But for the moment, I have to leave it at that. So the point is that if I'm arguing that the tendency to overcapacity persisted, a question immediately imposes itself. Why then didn't the world economy experience more serious recessions, even depressions, and thereby eventually shake out that high cost, low profit means of production, and thereby disperse overcapacity, and that way bring about the recovery of profitability? The main answer, there's a lot to be said about this, but the main answer, in my opinion, is that the governments of the advanced capitalist world, led to an ever-increasing extent by the United States, made sure that titanic volumes of credit were made available for ever more varied and baroque channels, both public and private, to firms and households, to soak up the surplus of supply over demand.
basically what we witnessed was a historically unprecedented and ever-increasing growth of borrowing, and this allowed the world economy to secure the demand it needed to counteract the problem of overcapacity and prevent depression. The bottom line, so to speak, is that for political reasons, governments through the, and also because in the short run, no capitalist likes a recession, governments through the expansion of borrowing forestalled the deep recessions or depressions that had historically eliminated excess capacity and that way allowed the economy to regain its profitability and its dynamism. Nevertheless, the outcome of this was the predicament that the world economy as faced as it entered the new millennium around the year 2000. On the one hand, the growth of borrowing at levels that continued to come near or break all previous records kept up demand and in that way prevented profitability from falling even further or past a certain point. In particular, the spectacular growth of debt kept the economy turning over in the wake of the serious recessions 1974-5, 79-82, the early 1990s, and the early 2000s. On the other hand, precisely because demand was kept up by increased borrowing, the shakeout of high-cost, low-profit means of production to eliminate overcapacity and substantially raise the rate of profit was slowed down and limited. As a consequence, overcapacity was reproduced and the rate of profit failed to recover. Because profitability failed to recover, investment growth, employment growth, wage growth continued to slow down, resulting in slow growth of aggregate demand and decreasing economic dynamism. So between 1973 and the present, we did not get, as we had in the past, a system-shaking crisis, like in the 30s. What we got instead was what I call the long downturn, featuring the perpetuation of stagnation over three decades. As the economy entered the new millennium, profit rates had still failed to recover, and so the long downturn continued. So again, take a look at pages 2 and 3, the table on page 4, and the line graphs on page 10 and 11 for the general picture. Okay, so this is a broad overview with a lot left out, very schematic, but we have limited time, and we'll have to discuss it further in the question period. So now, to get from that broad brushstroke of the long downturn to where we are specifically today, it's crucial, I think, to refer to a major shift that took place in the middle third of the 1990s. Up to the beginning of the 90s, the way in which the government had subsidized demand was through traditional Keynesianism. Basically, they cut taxes without reducing spending, or they increased spending without increasing taxes. Under Reagan, as we know, the high point, huge tax cuts and huge increases in military spending. So as a whole, Keynesian deficits as a percent of GDP everywhere across the advanced capitalist world grew ever greater as the long downturn extended itself and reached their highest point during the 80s and early 90s. But as we've seen, this process of demand management, while keeping the economy relatively stable, also rendered it increasingly stagnant. So in the parlance popular in the period, governments were getting increasingly less bang for the buck, less growth of GDP for given increase in borrowing. In the early 1990s, therefore, they had tried to do this in the early 1980s without success. In the early 1990s, therefore, in both the US and Europe, governments basically moving to the right and guided by neoliberal thinking, sought to break beyond stagnation by attempting to move to balanced budgets. This occurred under Clinton, Rubin, and Greenspan in the US, and in the run-up to the Maastricht Treaty for Single Currency in Europe in the EU. But although this fact does not loom large in most accounts of the period, this dramatic move to economic conservatism, what Clinton called Eisenhower economics, come neoliberalism, radically backfired. Because profitability had still failed to recover, firms responded to the reduction in the growth of demand that was brought about by balancing the budget, as was predictable, by trying to keep their share of the market, not by increasing investment so as to increase productivity, but by directly cutting costs. They reduced wage growth, brought down employment growth, and reduced the increase in investment. But these choices resulted in a huge hit to aggregate demand. During the first half of the 1990s, both Europe and Japan experienced devastating recessions, the worst in the post-war period, and the U.S. people here will remember experienced a so-called jobless recovery. So by mid-decade, the capitalist economies and their governments faced an impasse. They'd given up on Keynesianism with a big political flourish. Moreover, they wanted to stick with balanced budgets so as to keep wage growth down, to control the size of the welfare state, and repress inflation. But the problem was that this right-wing alternative had precipitated sharp economic slowdown and threatened stability. In fact, in 1995, in order to prevent the German and Japanese manufacturing economies from seizing up, the U.S. was obliged to agree to push up the dollar and allow the market again to decline, allowing Japanese and German competitiveness to increase, their manufacturing profitability to recover a bit, but undermining U.S. competitiveness and threatening demand in the U.S. even further. The outcome was a shift to an entirely new form of regulating the economy, which we could call asset price Keynesianism, or more simply, bubblenomics. This is where our friend, our still friend in the Middle East, Federal Chair Alan Greenspan comes in. As people may remember, in 1996, Greenspan made that famous warning about irrational exuberance in the stock market. And of course, there was irrational exuberance, because profitability in the real economy was going down while the stock market was going up. But in fact, the stock market continued to rise, and as we know, Greenspan did absolutely nothing about it, a fact not lost on investors. As the economic expansion continued, he not only failed to raise huge interest rates in the normal way, but in fact he lowered them at every point at which there was the slightest movement in the stock market, the slightest worry. For example, in the late summer 1997, when the Asian crisis was getting started, or especially in late 1998, when what was going on was a seizing up of financial markets. And then again in 1999, in the turn to what they thought might be a millennium crisis, but really another excuse to keep the stock market going and the economy turning over. As a result, we saw a record run up of the stock market, even as profits flattened out and fell. And on page 7, I think, should be a graph on profits and stock prices, 1995 to 2000, I think it's
there. Yeah, page 6.
And it's 6.
No, 6.
It's on 6. So, but there was, of course, a method to Greenspan's madness. By keeping interest rates down, he created the conditions where people could borrow easily, invest in the stock market, and drive up equity prices. As companies' stock market valuation rose, they were worth more, so they were in turn able to borrow money more easily. At the same time, especially tech companies, which experienced the biggest increases, were able to, biggest stock increases, I should say, were able to issue their overvalued shares to raise massive funds. This gave companies of all kinds an enormous increase in the capacity to invest, which was, of course, extremely paradoxical. For at this very time, profitability was going down. But the fact was that firms were flush with cash, despite their declining profitability, and this made it possible for them to drive a huge economic takeoff between 1995 and 2000. Investment grew fast, employment grew fast. We had, in other words, the famous new economy boom, which needs to be understood as a direct expression of the epic-making, government-sponsored stock market bubble of the era. Simply put, Greenspan had found a way to subsidize demand by making firms and rich people richer and allowing them to spend. According to Greenspan himself, between 1995 and 2000, the so-called wealth effect of the stock market run-up amplified GDP growth by one-third, from an anemic 3% to a healthy 4%. But the problem was that the new economy boom was without real foundations. This was because profitability remained in trouble and got worse. The growth of borrowing drove up stock prices in defiance of profits, and ratios between the prices of company stocks and their earnings reached an all-time high. At the same time, the growth of borrowing drove up output. But because output grew in the face of already existing overcapacity, profitability fell even further, and it was only a matter of time until there would be a serious recession. In fact, in the year 2000, the new economy boom came to an abrupt end. Overcapacity all across the manufacturing sector made for a huge fall in profitability. Meanwhile, the long expansion, much extended by the stock market bubble, ultimately drove up wages near the end of the decade and squeezed profits in the economy outside of manufacturing. The stock market crashed, the economy went into recession. Now, symptomatically of what I'm contending is the underlying problem here, the underlying problem of manufacturing overcapacity and profitability, recession was almost totally focused on the manufacturing sector, the place where overcapacity was concentrated. The fall in the manufacturing profit rate accounted for the entire economy-wide fall in profitability between 2000 and 2002. The loss of jobs in manufacturing, 3 million jobs, a fifth of the manufacturing sector, accounted for all the jobs lost in the economy between 2000 and 2004. There was no increase in the manufacturing capital stock for 4 years, and this accounted for all the decline in the growth of the capital stock for the whole economy at this time. Simply put, the new economy bubble had very much exacerbated already existing manufacturing overcapacity, and the resulting recession delivered a huge shock to the system. In 2000 and 2001, GDP and investment declined more rapidly than at any other point during the post-war period, and it looked like there might be a serious recession or even depression. But at this point, Alan Greenspan came to the rescue again with his new form of Keynesianism, the so-called asset price Keynesianism. By this time, housing prices had already been growing up as rich people had taken their money out of the stock market and put it in the housing market. Greenspan brought down interest rates extremely rapidly, and he kept them below zero in real or price-adjusted terms for 3 years. So doing, he was aided and abetted by leading central banks across the world, but similarly lowered the cost of borrowing, opening the way to a world flooded with liquidity. People could now borrow money cheaply, and demand for houses rose rapidly. As a result, housing prices now skyrocketed between 2000 and 2006, just as the prices of stocks had skyrocketed between 95 and 2000. Because people's houses were now worth much more than before, they could borrow much more against the house's value. So between 2000 and 2005, so-called mortgage equity withdrawals, I hope people intuitively know what that is. Because if, I don't know, New York, everywhere else, people have houses, their house values went up, and they refinanced, and they took the money out. That's mortgage equity withdrawals. They rose in a historically unprecedented manner as households used their residence in today's parlance like an ATM machine. So the result was that household borrowing as a percentage of household income and of GDP smashed all records. That record borrowing made possible a huge increase in the growth of personal consumption, and personal consumption basically drove the boom, especially by way of driving the greatest boom in the construction industry in the U.S. post-war history. You can see this by taking a look at page 7. This is on household borrowing. You can see this last turn up in the graph that borrowing is a percentage of GDP. In fact, personal consumption plus residential investment accounted for just about 100% of the growth of GDP in the first 5 years of the current business cycle, which began at the start of 2001. Without the stimulus from housing, meaning this wealth effect of housing plus construction, GDP growth between 2000 and 2005 would have been a minuscule 1.6% instead of the not too great 2.3% it actually was. So that the housing bubble increased GDP growth by almost 50%. In the same period, of course, the Bush administration was creating record Keynesian fiscal deficits of the old John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan sort by way of his enormous tax breaks to the corporations and run-up of military spending. So Kennedy, Reagan, Bush. The bottom line is that although during this cycle the economy has been subject to unprecedented economic stimulus by way of the housing bubble, government deficits, and eventually the devaluation of the dollar, it has limped along at the slowest pace of the post-war epoch. Simply put, well before the financial crisis hit last August, since 2000, despite all the hype, we've had a very weak economy. But the question is, what will be the outcome? It was Greenspan's idea to rely on the wealth effect of housing to allow households to vastly increase their borrowing, and in that way to vastly increase their consumption. The growth of consumption would drive the economy, while corporations recover their profit rates as they worked off their excess capacity.
Sooner or later, profitability would rise, corporations would begin to increase investment and employment, and once again, drive the economy forward. In the meantime, households increase borrowing and consumption based on rising housing prices to keep the economy going. But the problem is that today, almost 7 years after Alan Greenspan started to stimulate the economy with his low interest rates, aided by Bush's fiscal deficits, the corporations have still barely responded. Employment growth has been by far the slowest of the post-war period, not even half the rate it was during the 1990s. Investment has also grown very slowly. Capital stock, meaning the amount of plant and equipment available in real terms, grew by 11% between 2000 and 2006 total. Real wages, leaving aside benefits, have stagnated. In other words, up until now, the corporations have not yet begun to shoulder their responsibility for pushing the economy forward. As a result, to repeat, the growth of GDP in this business cycle has been the slowest for any comparable period since World War II, and overall the economy has been weak. What explains this? What explains this pattern, and what can we expect now? It seems to me that Greenspan's policy is turning out to be counterproductive, actually backfire. At bottom, as you would expect, firms, in the wake of the profitability problems in 2000-2001 and longer term, they focus on recovering their profits. So what they've done is cut back and held back on spending of all sorts, above all employment and spending on plant and equipment. And especially they've sought to regain their profitability by holding down wages. So during the cyclical, and this is one of the most spectacular numbers I've ever seen, honestly. During the cyclical upturn, from the last quarter of 2001 through the end of 2005, profits in the non-financial sector rose by 84.1%, compensation by 15.8%. Put another way, the increase in profits accounted for an astounding 43.8% of the total increase in net GDP in that period. By comparison, usually the profit share is normally about 17-18%. No, I'm talking about the increase in GDP that's occurred in that period, not the total GDP share, but the increase. How much of the increase was profits, how much is wages, and 44% of it was profits. Quite amazing. Nevertheless, all this has made for only a partial, recovery of profitability. As the rate of profit for the business cycle as a whole, and at this point in the business cycle, remains well below even the reduced levels of the 1990s. Moreover, given the degree which the increase in profit rates has so far taken place by way of mainly by raising the rate of exploitation, making workers work harder, and paying them less per hour, one has reason to question, how much longer this can go on. So if you look at page 11, the graph of nine financial profit rate, as well as the accompanying tables, and also look at page 10, you get another version of the same thing. And you can see that at the end of those graphs, there's not been a recovery, and even there's a beginning of a little down. At the same time, the cost of securing, and this is what sort of the bottom line is, the cost of securing even this partial recovery of the profit rate has again been a major downward pressure on the growth of demand. And this has made for a huge underlying disincentive to invest and hire. It's true, of course, that the hyper-low interest rates supplied by the Fed and the central banks across the world have, till recently, by way of the housing bubble, kept the economy turning over, and this almost entirely by way of household borrowing and consumption plus construction, as I said. Nevertheless, the Fed's bubble and low interest rates have been highly ambivalent, to say the least, in their further effects. On the one hand, the demand created by the housing bubble has allowed high-cost, low-profit firms to continue in business and relieve them of the need to shed superfluous plant and equipment, further discouraging expansion of jobs and investment in the aggregate, a phenomenon we see all across the world economy. And I think if you look at page 8,
This is on investment as a percentage of GDP since 1973. And what you'll notice is that every single place, including the NICS, the dynamic Asian NICS, has suffered a decline in investment. The only exception, I think a big one, an important one, China. So you have the housing bubble, growth of demand, allowing firms to continue operating as before without either shedding their excess plant and equipment or investing, and all across the world economy. Meanwhile, the Feds and the other central banks' hyper-low interest rates, instead of encouraging investment in in plant and equipment, have made possible massive placements of money in paper assets of all sorts. As a consequence, we have had, until very recently, the blowing up of asset price bubbles of all kinds, in bonds, in commodities, and of course, especially in housing, and all sorts of housing-related financial instruments. According to The Economist, the world housing bubble between 2000 and 2005 was the biggest of all time, outrunning even that of 1929. Simultaneously, instead of investing in new plant and equipment or employing more workers, firms have been paying off their debts, paying out dividends, and buying their own stocks to drive up their value, particularly in the form of an explosion of mergers and acquisitions. In the U.S. over the last 4 years, both dividends and stock purchases as a share of retained earnings have exploded to their highest level of the post-war epoch. And the same sorts of things have been happening all across the world economy, in Europe, Japan, and Korea. This is globalization. The bottom line is that in the U.S. and across the world economy since 2000, we've had slow growth dependent on asset price bubbles in the real economy, and an extraordinary expansion in the financial or paper economy, on the other hand. You shouldn't need a Marxist to be able to predict that this is a process that cannot continue. And of course, as we know, just like the stock market bubble in the 90s eventually burst, the housing bubble has now crashed, so that the film of housing-driven expansion that we viewed during the economic expansion of the 2000s is now running backward. Today, house prices have already fallen by 5% from their 2005 peak. But this process has only just got started. It's estimated by Moody's that by the time the housing bubble has fully deflated in early 2009, house prices will have fallen by 15 to 20% in nominal terms, and even more in real terms, by far, without any close comparison, the greatest decline in post-war U.S. history. Just as the positive wealth effect, of the housing bubble drove the economy forward, the negative effects of the housing crash is driving it into recession. So with housing values declining, borrowing against housing is collapsing. Mortgage equity cash outs were running at about $300 billion a year at the end of the 1990s, but they more than tripled to $1 trillion a year in 2005, at the height of the boom. By the early part of 2007, these mortgage equity withdrawals had already fallen by half and are expected to disappear in 2008 and 2009. As a direct consequence, households are borrowing less. As they borrow increasingly less than before, they have to consume less than before. The underlying danger is that no longer able to putatively save through their rising housing values, households will suddenly begin to actually save, driving up the rate of personal savings, now at the lowest level in history, and radically pulling down consumption. If you look at the last, I think, number page 9, you can see how low the savings rate has gotten. And in 2005, six of those households had mortgage equity withdrawals, had a negative savings rate of 8%, the rest of households 0%. So over time, it's hard to see how the pressure to save more can fail to rise, further endangering the growth of household purchases that's driven the economy. In any case, thanks to the implosion of the housing bubble, plus the slowdown of jobs growth, already in the second quarter of this year, that is well before the financial crisis even hit, the increase in real total cash flowing into households, which had run about 4.4% in 2005 and 2006, had fallen to zero. In other words, if you add up households' real disposable income, plus their real home equity withdrawal, plus their real consumer credit borrowing, plus their capital gains, you see that the money that households actually had to spend had stopped growing. And this well before the financial crisis last summer. It's because the actual money households have at their disposal has ceased to rise, that the growth of consumer spending is now plummeting. And of course, consumer spending is what basically drove the economy since 2000. It's because the growth of consumer spending is plunging that the economies of California, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin, which taken together account for more than a quarter of total U.S. GDP, are already in recession. You can do the same thing, but Vivek will let me, with a series of industries which are already in recession. So just as you don't need a weatherman to predict yesterday's storm, you don't need an economic analyst to predict a recession which is already underway. The main question now is just how bad it will be, and I'll have to stop here. We'll have to consider the financial crisis that came out of this, the subprime crisis, in the discussion that follows. Thanks an awful lot.
Our next speaker is Sam Gindel.
And now for something completely different. I think the crisis is on the left, not in capitalism. And sure, we'll probably have a recession. We'll probably have some slow growth after that. But I will predict that capitalism will survive. Let me just read something from Greenspan as well, just to start. It's the only quote from Greenspan I use. The speculative imbalances in the housing market, the tremendous increase in mortgage debt, and the large dollar overhang abroad make our present situation precarious. That was from an article in 1980 called The Great Malaise, worried about where capitalism was going. And I'm not reading that to make the point that the world doesn't change and everything remains the same, but in fact to make two other points, one of which is that things have changed. Capital and the American state responded to that particular problem, and that's how we got neoliberalism. And the first thing to understand about neoliberalism when we talk about whether it's going to unravel or not is that neoliberalism is not just an ideology, and it's not just a policy, but it's a form of accumulation that is really deeply rooted in what capitalism is today. We can't talk about neoliberalism unraveling without really raising the question of whether capitalism is unraveling. When we're talking about neoliberalism now, we're talking about globalization, we're talking about finance, we're talking about the structure of corporations in terms of networks of production across borders, and we're talking about the restructuring of states, and we're talking about the intensification of competitiveness. So that's the first point I really want to emphasize. Neoliberalism is really deeply rooted. It's not just something that can be changed by a change of orientation in terms of electoral politics or a change in policy. The second thing, and here Bob and I really disagree, the point that I want to make is that after 1980, and in response to the crisis that happened when neoliberalism came into place, we saw the most dynamic capitalism in the next quarter of a century that we had ever seen before. And to make that point, it isn't about looking at economic statistics. We can't be economists about this. What we have to look at is how much the world has changed in the last quarter of a century. And that's what the indication is of how dynamic that system is. I don't mean dynamic in terms of helping people or being good for anybody. I mean in terms of capital itself. And it's not useful, I think, to compare it to the 50s and 60s. Those are relatively unique periods. Capital doesn't need high rates of profit to survive. It just has to make sure that it's got rates of profit. Until last couple of years, the profit share in GDP was the highest in history. So when I say it's dynamic, what I mean is the ability of capital to actually expand all private spaces, to take things that used to be public in terms of utilities, in terms of my own country, in terms of healthcare, and to actually bring them into the private sphere. That's been phenomenal. And not just when it privatizes them. It's been able to commercialize things that remain in the public sphere, but now are run on a private basis. Capital has phenomenally commodified labor in terms of fragmenting it, precarious unemployment, part-time work, outsourcing. Capitalism has restructured production. We've had a massive change from manufacturing to services. We've had massive changes within manufacturing. There's all kinds of new high-tech sectors in terms of biotech and computers and telecommunications that have emerged. This is part of capitalism's dynamism. We've had a defeat of the left, including social democracy, selling neoliberalism itself in virtually every country. This is part of capitalism's dynamism. We've had capitalism expand now into Eastern Europe. We've had China integrated into capitalism. We've got capital accumulation in India, a major site of accumulation. Capitalism today is running at, its unemployment rate is relatively low. It's broken the back of inflation. This is dynamism, and we can't underestimate this. If we're going to have a politics, we have to understand what we're up against. We're up against a very powerful capitalism that is not dying. The next point I want to make is that there are contradictions, and I want to raise three of them, and they're of different kinds. One is the fact of legitimacy. And obviously there's the question of the international stuff that Vivek talked about in Iraq. I don't want to, people know all about that. I want to emphasize the question of legitimacy in the developed countries themselves. One of the things that neoliberalism meant was that capital used to think in terms of accumulation plus legitimacy, if you want, stability. It then couldn't afford the legitimacy, and it reduced the importance of legitimacy in how capitalism operates. And it found that it can basically do without it because it could replace that legitimacy with fatalism. I'll return to that. But there is a contradiction. Capitalism isn't legitimating things in terms of equality, in terms of insecurity, everything that you could, the lists are so long. Katrina, the subprime housing thing, which isn't just about finance, it's about people actually losing their homes. There's all the openings in the world in terms of legitimacy. That's one contradiction of a particular kind. The other two contradictions I want to emphasize is that the way capitalism is managed today isn't just because the American state is omnipotent. The American state can only manage capitalism through other states. And that's a very complex process. The process of making a global capitalism is very complex. And when you do this through other states, it means that all the social forces in all these other states end up to be very important, which means that you do have potential crises always reoccurring because of the balance of social forces in particular states. And the third contradiction is that the form of discipline in this new capitalism is financial markets, and financial markets are inherently volatile. So on the one hand, you've got a capitalism that's going to have all kinds of legitimation problems, and a capitalism that's going to have all kinds of crises repeatedly occurring. But before I get to that, let me say something about the legitimation aspect that I think is important. There's the legitimation aspect, and the question is, well, so how come we're not seeing this? How come people aren't rebelling? If somebody would have asked me in the 70s, predicted what would happen in the 80s and 90s, and said, what do you think will happen? I said, what do you mean what will happen? People will be in the streets. Nobody would take this. I thought 10% unemployment would be a big deal when it happened in the 70s. So what happened? What we have to understand about neoliberalism is that part of its power is the power to reproduce itself ideologically. Neoliberalism has led to workers internalizing the values of neoliberalism. What I mean by that is workers have to survive. And when there's an absence of a way of surviving through collective action, they find individual ways of doing it. So what do? They work longer hours. They go into debt. They see a tax cut as a wage increase. They invest in the stock market because they don't know what's going to happen to their pension fund. Well, this has implications for the capacities of the class, because now it means it's not struggling through picket lines, it's not in the streets, it's not doing things politically, it's doing things individually and in a fragmented way, and it loses its collective capacities. And then the next thing happens is, well, how do you survive? Well, you just have to do more of the same. You just have to work more hours or work two jobs. So it's being internalized in that sense. Second of all, there's been an incredible fragmentation within the working class. We spend a lot of time talking about the inequality between the classes, but there's an amazing inequality that has grown inside the working class. Some of that is actually being narrowed now, because those sections of the working class that were doing well because of this fragmentation are so weak that they're seeing their own wages cut. But that has been part of weakening the working class and integrating them into neoliberalism. Competitiveness. It used to be that workers would fight their bosses, and their bosses might say, we need profits so we can reinvest. Well, when they said that, there was still some notion of, well, there's some kind of a class thing going on here. They want profits, we want wages. Now they don't talk that language anymore. Now it's that, what about profits or not profits? It's about we have to be competitive. We're all in the same boat. So there is a corporatist dimension to this that again reinforces neoliberalism. You got to survive, you have to compete. The most amazing thing that neoliberalism has done hasn't been the things we've lost. You can make a list of all of them. The most powerful thing it's done is it's lowered our expectations. We no longer think we have a right to certain things or that certain things are possible, and that affects our capacity to fight, and therefore neoliberalism's ability to reproduce itself. And you see this in unions. One of the things that's happened to trade union leaders is they've discovered it's not such a bad thing if people lower their expectations. I can tell my workers, there's not really much you can do. It's globalization, it's neoliberalism, it's the nasty state, it's just competitiveness. What can you do? And they've gotten very comfortable with doing this. So unions themselves have become part of reproducing this. And the net result of this is that, yes, capitalism can't just legitimate itself by promising us things anymore. Now it legitimates itself through fatalism. What else is there to do? It's the only system that exists. What can you do? I need some water. Solidarity stuff.
I need some water too.
Okay, let me get to the second point that I was making, was that capitalism still has to reproduce itself through states and through financialization, both of which mean that there are a lot more crises. I want to stress that there's a lot more crises. But there's a flip side to this that we don't spend enough time thinking about, and that is the capacity to manage crises. Now, the capacity to manage crises has to do with the fact that the American state and other states have actually learned something over the years, and they've developed mechanisms for limiting crises, not to prevent them. When you read their literature, they don't talk about preventing crises anymore, or not that much about preventing crises. They tend to think about how do we limit them so they don't get too deep, they don't spread internationally. And so the American state has some of that capacity, these capacities in terms of cooperation through international institutions. The Canadian government yesterday lowered the interest rate, and so did Britain, which precedes the Fed lowering its interest rate, because otherwise it would have been harder for them to do. Now, I don't know whether that happened through some actual coordination and planning that we don't know about, or whether it was just kind of a natural thing. But what you do see are two crucial things. One of the barriers to managing capitalism has always been inter-imperial rivalry of some kind. I would argue that that isn't an issue. There are tensions between states, there are conflicts, but everybody sees that if the U.S. is in trouble, it's a systemic crisis, and they understand that. And that's why you wouldn't see anybody today raising their interest rates on the argument that we need to do this because of inflation concerns. They're sensitive to what this would do in the U.S. The second thing that I think is crucial to managing crises is the weakness of the labor market. I think that, you know, we've often thought in terms of we're not going to have a revolution unless we have a left movement and the working class. I'm not sure we're going to have a deep crisis if we don't have a strong labor movement, because all they do is put it on the backs of workers. I mean, you take a look at how much more of a crisis do we need in the auto industry, and what do auto workers do in respond to it? They say, gee, we've got privatized healthcare, maybe we should privatize it even a little bit more and have the union take the risks for it. They've got their wages, which, you know, in the middle of the American dollar sinking like a stone and therefore competitiveness rising for workers, what are they doing? They cut the wage rate for new hires in half. A wonderful way to build the next generation of new militants. First thing you do is you tell them the union just cut your wages in half, because they don't get to vote in the collective agreements. Now, as long as that happens, what does that mean? It means that the state has enormous space for doing things. The working class isn't the limit. So, for example, if the working class in this country was militant today, and they were worried about inflation, they'd raise interest rates. If they raised interest rates, they would have an amazing collapse, given the instability in the financial markets now. But they don't have to do that. They don't have to worry about inflation. They can let the dollar fall. They can let interest rates fall lower, because they know the working class isn't going to take advantage of this. I think one of the things we have to think about when we think about crises is, for one thing, they're historical. I mean, every crisis, we're not talking about whether it's going to be recession or not, or a slowdown. That's not the interesting question. The question is, are we going to have something like the 30s again, or something that happened at the end of the 19th century? Now, crises are always different, because every solution to a crisis creates new institutions. When you look at the crisis at the end of the 19th century, you didn't have the multinational corporate form, you didn't have states that had fiscal capacities, you didn't have all kinds of mechanisms. So one thing is that we have to look at these historically. But the second thing, which I really want to emphasize, is that crises have to be politicized. We have to understand them in the context of not just economics, but what is the state doing, and what capacity has the state to do, and what are the limits on the state, and what is the class struggle that's occurring around this. And in the absence of limits on those things, I'm arguing that crises, the odds are that crises will be limited. So let me return to this question of the unraveling of neoliberalism. And why I think that we have to think about this more in terms of the crisis of the class. There's a politics of crisis which I just want to raise. Whenever I'm in an audience of left people, everybody cheers when somebody says we're going to have a crisis. And I've never understood that. And I don't understand it for a couple of reasons. One is that workers are normally weaker in the crisis, and I don't know why we'd be optimistic about it. The second is, whenever there's a crisis, the first thing that people actually think is, boy, wasn't yesterday terrific? Wouldn't it be wonderful to get back to the Clinton era? And this is not what we're about. And, there's nothing automatic about crises when we don't have a left to take advantage of it and take advantage of the openings to make them into something meaningful. And we have to take that seriously. And of course, there's also the danger that if people did kind of spontaneously resist this with pure militancy, maybe it would be more of a fascistic response. What would it actually mean if there was a crisis? And I'll conclude with just a couple of points. One is that we have so many, the problem of legitimacy is something we really have to take seriously. I mean, never mind capitalism getting into a crisis, we should be able to say that capitalism, as we've seen it over the last few decades, sucks when it's working well. That should be our argument. If we can't convince people that the kind of capitalism we've had lately, and I'm thinking about what it's done internationally in terms of imperialism, I'm thinking about what it's done in terms of insecurity, in terms of inequality. If we can't convince people that this kind of a capitalism is bad, we're going to have trouble convincing them if there is a recession and they just want to get back to this kind of a capitalism. So the crisis is on the left. The real question is, how do we start organizing? Why can't we take advantage of the openings that we have? Waiting for a crisis is not going to solve the problem. And I'm still convinced, I can't prove this, and I don't think I have the capacity to forecast how bad this next recession is going to be, but I would tend to think that we're going into this recession with unemployment at about 4.5%, with inflation not a problem, relatively low interest rates, the Democrats not particularly representing anything, the labor movement incredibly weak and ready to take more ship if necessary. I'm not sure why this should turn out to be a crisis for capitalism. I never thought that the crisis for capitalism would come out of the weakness of labor, but out of the strength of labor one day. So I just want to finish with that point. The point is a challenge to us about how do we finally start organizing and developing a left that can actually be a player. Thank you.